Storyworthy Media, the best in story-driven content.
Hey, it's Kathy Ladman, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we come to you from Gibsonia, Pennsylvania. Tricked you, Christine. You thought we were going to come from my hometown,
finally,
but we're coming from your hometown.
Wow, that's amazing. It's true. I grew up in Gibsonia, Pennsylvania.
It's an unincorporated community.
Is it really? I didn't know that.
Yes, it is. Unincorporated. That's why you burned your trash. By law,
yeah,
you have to burn the trash in the backyard if you're unincorporated.
And we had a septic system. So there you go. I didn't even know all this.
Yeah, so it's really not even a place.
It's very rural. There are no sidewalks in my neighborhood. There were no streetlights.
Horrifying.
It was very rural.
I remember going to see my cousins in Peoria, and they lived in a neighborhood with no sidewalks, and I didn't know what the fuck was wrong with these people. I was like, how can there not be sidewalk? What is wrong with you?
It just goes yard to yard to yard.
Yard to yard and that sort of thing, and you're walking in the street, and it's like, I'm going to get killed by a car.
No, there's nobody there. That's the thing. That's how they work it out. They don't need sidewalks. There's very few people there.
All right.
So we're coming from Gibsonia tonight because our guest, Kathy Ladman, the one and only fantastic comedian, Kathy Ladman, brings forth the topic, You Can Never Go Home.
You Can Never Go Home. Now You Can't Go Home Again, which is a famous novel by Thomas Wolfe.
Okay.
This is You Can Never Go Home.
And I'll tell you something, Hannes. I hear her coming at this loud and clear. First of all, I read the article that she's going to be referring to. But it is so true how you can never go home.
You and I have discussed how you have no desire to go home, and yet you go home fairly often because you still have family there.
I go home.
You have your daughter that you have to take there.
I haven't been to Pittsburgh in 2.5 years, and my daughter hasn't been there in 4.5 years.
Me, who always waxes, as you say, poetic about Milwaukee and how awesome it is, I've been there in 7 years.
Because you only have one schizophrenic brother there, and you don't know anybody else in the town.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Legally, he's 4 people. According to the census, it's 4 people. But yes, exactly. There's no particular reason, but I want to, like, I tell you how wonderful it is and where the restaurants are, yet I don't go.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
But here's the thing. You're talking about physically going home.
And I
don't think that's what Kathy's talking about. And that's not what I'm talking about either. You can never go home. I think it's referring to something a little bit bigger. And that is that when you do see people from your hometown, whether that's your family or people from high school or college or whatever it might be, once you've come to Los Angeles and you've tried to do something a little more than just work for somebody else and get a paycheck, once you try to be creative, you try to step outside of your bounds and say, I want to accomplish a little something that's not quite as concrete, it's hard then to turn around. Because I go back to Pittsburgh and I get, so have you thought about teaching, honey? Because I think you'd be a great teacher. And I'm 50. You know what I mean? No. I have not considered these other careers. Well, honey, I work down at the gym, and it's fantastic, and I run this club, and I do this down at the gym, and it's great to go to work every day. I'd love to go to work every day. Don't you miss not going to work every day?
God, that's the sickest thing I've ever heard in my life.
And so you have to understand that when you're talking about going home, it's kind of like when you don't understand where each person is coming from, it's hard to relate.
Yes.
And it's hard to keep my patience, and it's hard for me to even smile when I'm being
placated. Because basically they're saying, what you're doing, we consider ridiculous.
You're a little off. You don't really get it. And so there's just a disconnect. And that's why being in Los Angeles around other creative people and people who aren't just going for the paycheck or just for money all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I get it. I see my sister's houses. I get how big the houses are. I get the cars. I get the TVs and the vacations and the cruises. I get it. But we're just in different places. So I think that's what Kathy's referring to, is you can't go home. You cannot relate to people who don't understand what you're doing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I have a different take on it, just that I personally happen to have known about 7 people in the past year or 2 years or 3 years or 5 years who have left Los Angeles. They're like, I'm done with Los Angeles. I'm going to either to somewhere I've never lived before or I'm going to go back home. And they all came back. Every single one of them, they all came back.
Yeah.
It's like once you've lived here, you can't live somewhere smaller in a way too. I mean, I know what you're saying about the career, but it's also like, you know, you leave here and you go to Nashville. Nashville's awesome. It's hard if you can't live in
smaller haystack. You can't find the needles in the haystack. Out here, at least you can turn around and talk to somebody who, even if they've just gotten off the boat and they just got to Los Angeles and they're talking about this acting class and God forbid they met a Scientologist or whatever.
God forbid they're making headshots.
You still see a little bit of a spark of like there's some hope right there.
Yeah.
Somebody's keeping the faith. Somebody's trying to move forward. I always respect that.
I do respect that. Although I realize now as I've been here longer, every time I pass, there's a studio right in Lancashire, an acting studio right near where I live. And it's like there's a whole industry which is show business adjacent, which is teaching people to act, coaching people on acting, getting headshots. And like there's a whole
industry
of teachers who are looking at their class and going, there's one person in 100 that even has a chance to make this happen. And then there's the one that you don't think is talented and makes it anyhow, which is just weird. But it's like there's so many people trying to be performers out here.
Yeah.
That you can make money just not ever teaching a successful one or not ever developing the headshot
of a
successful
business.
One. No, exactly. But it's like you don't realize when you get here, you're like, this whole town is about show business. And you realize you're looking at it from the perspective of you're hanging around with a bunch of people who are getting headshots every 3 months. And eventually, you realize there are millions of people who just pass by every day and go, I wonder what the fuck goes on in there.
Yeah.
What is this acting studio? What is that? Because it's not theater. I've never seen a play there.
Well, okay.
No, I'm just saying.
But it's one part of the businesses in Los Angeles.
Yes.
But at least it's a pretty large sect, and it's a lot bigger than the show business scene in Pittsburgh.
No, there's one guy in Pittsburgh with an Instamatic. That's right, Instamatic. I like to do the up-to-date references for the kids.
Well, the point is, you can never go home. I tell you, I really relate to this. I don't know. It's a little hard because I have tried so many different avenues in this town, and I've gotten shot down and rejected so many times. And it's still better than the alternative. Although I have to say, recently I've been considering this new career path. I don't know if I told you this, Hannes.
Uh-huh.
And this is going to be way off.
No.
Yeah. I think I would make, because one of the reasons why I do, you know, I'm in show business and I'm trying to move ahead is because I feel like it's like one of my only talents. It's the only thing I know how to do.
Yeah.
Host, ask questions, be curious, get on stage, tell stories. That's what I can do. But here's something else I learned I do very well. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
I could be a hospice worker.
Oh.
I could help people die. I'm not kidding you. I'd be so, because I was with my dad, right? Like, I was so good at it.
No, I understand that, but it's like that's your big leap is I'm going to go right to where people are dying.
Well, either if I don't succeed in show business, I might go where people die.
So you can be like, well, I didn't get that Campbell Soup commercial, but at least I'm not dying like this guy.
No, I don't mean that. I mean that I have an ability to be very...
You are empathetic.
I'm empathetic. I'm compassionate. And I have a really good, I'm very strong at being in the moment. So when people are dying, like when my dad passed, I was so good with him. And I think I could do that for other people. How do you like that?
I think that it's noble.
No, I'm not trying to be noble.
No, I'm not saying.
I wouldn't even tell anybody about all the people that die around me.
Like Angela Lansbury in Murder, She Wrote. Everywhere you go, people die, and eventually somebody goes, maybe the old lady's killing them.
I mean, when people
she's surrounded
people would
by
say,
death.
Like, hey, how's it going? You know, people don't really want to know how you're doing. I wouldn't say, well, I just lost three people last night.
I guess I'm looking at it.
I would say fine, like I always say, but that doesn't mean it's fine.
Yeah, yeah. No, I couldn't. I mean, I was like that with my mom, but I don't know. If it was, doing it with strangers, that's a whole other, do people, I don't know, do you just go into hospice care or do you come
you don't
to
have
it
to
through
be a nurse.
Medicine?
No, you don't have to be a nurse. I've even kind of looked into it a little bit. You don't have to be a nurse. You don't have to have any medical training. You don't even pronounce them dead. you get to call in a nurse to do that part. But you just get to be with them. And I think that I have the ability that somebody could look at me, be with me, I hold their hand, and they could say, all right, I'm going to let go now. Like I could talk somebody into just saying, you know, let go.
Listen, I will tell you the story of Tonga again. It's like, no, I'm just going to go. It's okay. Hey, do you want to listen to my proposal for the game show? No, I'm going to go. I'm going to go now. Yeah. You play the early episodes. You play the episodes of Storyworthy that no one ever heard with the crazy people that we just never aired. And they're like, I'm ready to leave the earth. It's good.
Anyway,
we've taken quite an odd turn here.
I am really excited to hear Kathy Ladman tonight tell her story.
I think being a hospice worker is a great idea. And I could actually see myself doing it because I think that death is a beautiful thing. And I want to help people be comfortable. I think I'd be great at it. We should open a hospice business.
Come die with us. Die business. Laughing.
Okay. All right. I have to do this now. Die laughing. That's right. Oh, my God. It's like comedy traffic school.
Talk about death.
Come to our hospice.
So you guys are joining us on a perfect day. Here we are with Kathy Ladman. Before she comes on, I did want to mention that if you enjoy listening to Storyworthy, please support us by following us on Twitter and Instagram at Storyworthy. And why not click on our Amazon ad before you shop at Amazon?
Exactly. You can buy your Civil War pornography. You can buy your Civil War medical journals. Anything about the Civil War. I think they sell other things too.
Storyworthypodcast.com. You click on our banner and that helps us out.
Yeah, exactly. And just tell your friends. Just tweet our Twitter at Storyworthy to just in yours. Just say, hey, here's something I listen to. That's all you have to do.
That's all you have to do.
Just tell your friends. We need numbers, people. Don't selfish. I know you don't want to tell people. We're like a restaurant that you don't want to tell people is great because you won't be able to get a table anymore. But we're whores. We'll put in more tables. We will knock out the wall of the wig store next door and we'll expand.
More bandwidth. Yes. All right, you guys, wherever you are, stick around because Kathy Ladman is on her way. Next time on Storyworthy, we have comedian Jennifer Valley.
And I'll be talking about the most famous zip code in the world, 90210.
That's next time on Storyworthy. You are listening to Storyworthy. And we're back. We've left Gibsonia, and we're now in Las Vegas, California. We're home for quite a few years here.
I've been here 19 years in August. 19 years.
But in the same neighborhood, which in L.A. is a little unusual.
I've lived in four different places, all within two blocks of House of Pies. House of Pies is Ground Central. That's where it all happens. And from there, we move forward.
Except that you moved away. You were literally around the corner from House of Pies. And so I used to eat at House of Pies when I would come see you. And now I haven't been at House of Pies in years.
Well, I'm only at one block further, honey.
No, I'm talking about... No, not that. No, I'm talking farther back.
Oh, I see.
There you had that condo. Uh-huh. You were literally around the corner from the House of Pies.
Yeah, I was dating the waiter. That's what was happening. All right, you guys. Kathy Ladman's here right now.
Yeah, that was his pet name for you, the House of Pies. The House of Pie. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
All right, you guys.
Oh, it's dirty.
Kathy Ladman's here. She's a writer and an actress and a very well-known comedian. Now, not only has Kathy been on The Tonight Show 9 times,
woo-hoo!
She was actually the only female comic to appear on the last two of Johnny Carson's Tonight Show anniversary shows. And you've also seen her on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. She did her own HBO special One Night Stand. And she was awarded the American Comedy Award for Best Female Stand-Up Comic. You can find her over at KathyLadman.com, which, by the way, fantastic website. Whoever's doing that for you. Very clean, very efficient. I love that, KathyLadman.com.
She looks like she does it herself because she looks very complimented.
It's really good. There's all sorts of things on there. You can see all these different little clips that she does. She has this one series on there called the No Makeup Series, which just cracks me up. Basically, she's talking with no makeup on. It's just like that.
Wow. I do that every day.
You can also find her on Twitter at Kathy Ladman. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Kathy Ladman.
I don't know who came up with the phrase, you can never go home, but man, that person was onto something. I mean, you can go home. You can physically get yourself there. But oh boy, it's not the same. I grew up in New York City, Queens, and I left my parents' home to go away to college when I was barely 16. I was not happy living there for a long time. There were so many arguments, so much yelling. There was a lack of kindness and extreme imposed austerity. My dominant motivating force had always been fear. Do well in school or else. Clean your room or else. Place the needle on the record and ever so carefully lower the plexiglass lid on the turntable so as not to disturb the needle or else. I want to be clear here. There are some wonderful, indelible memories I have of my childhood. Great stuff. Yes, it was a mixed bag, but I was driven to save myself. I know this. I remember pacing in my bedroom at 8 or 9 years old, counting the years before I could go away to college. My oldest sister had just left for school, and it lit a fire in me. 5th, 6th, 7th. Only 8 more years to go. That became my raison d'etre. I did whatever I had to do. My anxiety level was high, knowing that excellence was my only way out. I did well. I put my head down. I worked my heart out. In the 6th grade, we took a test that would determine our junior high school path. I, like both of my sisters, scored well enough to give me the option to do the SP, which was special progress. There was a choice. I could do the 2-year SP, where I'd do 7th and 8th grades in 1 year, and then the 9th grade next. Or I could do the 3-year SP, where each year was enriched. That sounded confusing, didn't it? But it makes sense. Both of my sisters had done the 2-year SP, and I was determined to do that. It would get me 1 year closer to getting away to college. Since my sisters had set the precedent, it seemed like it was a given. For some reason, my mother didn't want me to do the 2-year SP. I'm not sure why. Maybe she saw how anxious I was, and she thought that the 3-year program would be a better pace for me. I was adamant. The kids in the 3-year were nerdy. I just couldn't be in class for 3 years with them. And of course, in retrospect, they were incredibly smart and they did very well in life. I simply had to speed up my path, though. I would die if my mother made me do the 3-year. I would die. I was desperate. Well, my mother saw how much this meant to me and she relented. Thank you, Mom. I didn't quite understand why she was pushing me to do the 3-year plan back then. I don't recall her ever explaining it to me, having a conversation with me. I wonder if her perspective would have influenced me if she had explained it to me. I'm guessing no. My mother knew how difficult it was to live with my father. I think that the unspoken was clear. So I got to shave a year off my sentence. I barely remember high school, which started in the 10th grade. I didn't have much to do with anyone. I had friends, but not close ones. There was Rhonda from elementary school. She and I would have pizza often after we got off the city bus going home from high school. But that's all I remember. It's very fuzzy. And I think I have an excellent memory. But I guess we remember what is memorable. And high school was an unhappy time for me, particularly at home. My father was more than strict. He kept me on a short rope. I found out in my junior year that I could graduate in January of my senior year if I took the required courses. I leapt on this. I told my mother I wanted to do this. I don't really remember her reaction specifically. If I had to guess, I'd say she was not pleased. I was, after all, extremely young, and she knew how happy I was at school and at home, so I think she was afraid for me to go out into the world, but I don't remember there being much of an argument from her. I went about setting things up for my early graduation as soon as I possibly could. You can go to a state school, you can go to a city school for free. That's your choice. That's it. That was my father's commentary, spoken in anger for some reason. Anger was his MO. Look, New York City has some fine city colleges, but there was no fucking way I was staying in that house for 4 more years. I had been unhappy and constrained for no reason for too long. I applied to every state university, Albany, Buffalo, Binghamton, and I waited, and I heard nothing. It was the autumn of my senior year. I turned 16 in October. I shunned the notion of a Sweet 16 party like many girls at the time were having. I asked for an entry-level stereo instead. It made me happy. It was December already, and I hadn't heard anything. I'd be finishing high school in a month, and I didn't know where it was going to go. I don't even know if I'd gotten any rejection letters. It was just silence. Finally, in mid-December, I got an acceptance letter from Albany. Finally, I was so relieved and so excited. I was thrilled. I told them at my job at Walbaum Supermarket that I'd be leaving work soon. Yay, I was going away. And I didn't have to work at Walbaum's anymore. My parents drove me up to school in January. It was about a three-hour drive from Queens. My dorm was at the old downtown campus, the same place my oldest sister had been about 7 years before. I was nervous. I was young, but I knew that I was doing the right thing for me. SUNY, State University of New York at Albany, was where I spread my wings. It was where I met people of different backgrounds, where I made great friends, where I fell for guys, where I had my heart broken, where I lost my virginity. I worked moderately hard at most of my classes, really engaged with some others, dropped out of a few. It was where my love for movies deepened, where I smoked pot, dropped acid, had deep conversations. SUNY was where I found myself, at least a part of myself that was never accessed before. I had fun. I was passionate about things around me. I was actually happy. After college in my early 20s, I was in and out of my parents' house a few times. It was a very tough time in my life. More on this in another story. But when I was able to leave and follow my heart, I knew I was on the right path. I lived in Manhattan, and I fell in love with my city of birth. Then I moved to Los Angeles in 1985. I used to get back to New York about four times a year, I think. My work took me there. Now I get back less and less often. And when I'm there, I see how I've changed. The dynamics of my family system are still in motion. I've worked hard to figure it out and to extricate myself from the patterns that were not working for my well-being. Today, when I'm there, when I say what I need, when I stand up for myself, I'm pretty unpopular. It's hard. I want to belong. And I guess I still do, but in a different way, on different terms. I suppose I can't go home. Not in the way it was. I won't allow myself to get swept into that current anymore. It happens in all families. We open the front door and we begin to dance the dance that we've done with our relatives for years. I've worked so hard to learn to not take the bait, to change. I still take it sometimes, but not nearly as often. And what happens when you don't take the bait? You're hungry, but then you find better, more nourishing food. It's different now at home. The house where we grew up, where my parents lived for 51 years, is gone. We gather at my sister and brother-in-law's beautiful home now. Some of it makes me sad. I see the passage of time, my life, their lives, where we've all been, where we all are. I'm also glad to know that I have found a lot of myself and that I'm aware there's more to come. It isn't always easy. Jesus Christ, it is not. There are lean times, confusing times, times when I don't know which way is up. It's like when I've been tumbled by a wave and I'm panicking because I don't know where the surface is. I need to find it so that I can break through and take a deep breath again. I finally do. I breathe gratefully and I stand up to face the next wave. I've chosen a path that I was not raised to choose. Yet my family and my past inform most of my work. Funny. And for that, I'm grateful. What is home, anyway? I think it might be a place that is in constant motion. As one changes, home changes. Home is within me. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out. I'll get back to you.
That's such a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Who printed that for you?
Some feel strange. Sometimes, I'm so used to doing speaking in a more extemporaneous fashion that when I read my stories out loud, it still feels kind of odd.
Who published this for you?
It was I published it on Medium at this place, The Coffeelicious, where I've published a few things before.
Yeah. It's really good.
Thank you.
It's such a good piece.
And Thank you. Yeah, it's like you go back into old patterns, whether you want to or not, happens all the time.
Well, and even if people are dead, even if people have passed on, their role is still there.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I can hear my father admonishing me still now, and he's been dead for almost 10 years.
Now, what year was your dad born?
1919.
So was it a depression thing for him then? Did he grew up?
My parents both grew up in the depression.
So he was like 20 when the depression was 30.
Well, he was 20 when he was 20 when the stock market.
He was 10 when the stock market crashed. So he grew up in his teenage years. He was in the depression.
And so that's why they're so angry, though. Don't you think that has something to do with it?
But I know parents who are the same age from the same era, and I see everybody come through things differently. I know people who've gone through the Holocaust and have come through differently.
You know, it's funny that you would say that. It's not funny, but it's like you're making me think of like so much of it is genetics. And just that image, when I was a kid, my dad, who I later realized was crazy, I thought he was just being an asshole and he was just being mean, but it's like he would talk about terrible things. He would talk about my mom and how much he suffered and this and that. And I would think to myself, although I never had the balls to say, you know, there are people who actually like literally like went through the Holocaust, like went through concentration camps, and they have a better attitude than you do. It's completely within yourself.
It depends. I mean, you can talk to so many different people who've gone through the same experience, and some of them choose to learn from it, and some of them choose to be embittered by it. You know, it really depends on how you want to live your life, you know. By the way, I just want you to know that I was just home in New York last week, and my mother still brought up teaching to me.
She's 90. She's 94. And she asked you
She said, you know, plus she has short-term memory loss, which, you know, sometimes is great because she doesn't forget when she forgets when we argue. But she also forgets the things that she said to me. So she says them over and over. And so she says, you know, whenever I bring up teaching, you seem to want me to stop talking about it. And, you know, I used to like argue with her about it, and I said, "Mom, you know, it's not my path. Okay, it's just not my path." And you know, I mean, I've been pretty successful.
Yeah. When your parents would see you on the Tonight Show, did they make comment at that time? Would they get excited? Did they have their friends over?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. And everybody publicized it.
Good.
And it was great. But you know what? My family has been very, very supportive of me when I'm visibly doing well.
Yeah.
When I'm not visibly doing well, you know, I'm in a transition now. I'm kind of moving from, you know, I don't do the road anymore.
Right, of course.
Yeah. And I'm moving away from one thing and I'm not quite at the other thing yet.
Yeah.
So that they are very uncomfortable with that.
Okay, what about if I just play the devil's advocate? Because I get this from my family too. Mm-hmm. But what about the idea that they just don't have the language, they don't have the wherewithal or the knowledge about what we do to make comments that we would deem appropriate? In other words, they don't know what to say.
They don't. They live in a pretty small world.
But even if they live in a big world, it is such an odd choice that we make to purposefully
But the thing is, if you live in a bigger world, which I mean by intellectually, artistically, philosophically, then you embrace the arts in a different way. Yeah. I mean, look, my sister goes to so many plays in New York.
Yeah.
They go to theater so often.
Yeah.
But when it comes to really understanding the soul of an artist, I don't think that they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can't imagine that someone they grew up with and related to is one of those artists. You know, think that an artist is this mythic figure of someone who's, you know, you've seen in movies and they're just art all the time and they're prints.
Yeah.
You know, it's like every moment of their lives is filled with art. And it's like, you know, after Prince passed away, I saw a picture of him. He was going to his usual Walgreens, which is in suburban Minneapolis. It's like sometimes You're just a person who goes to a Walgreens.
Right.
And they're like, well, you can't be an artist.
Right.
I know what a moron you are. Right. This can't be, you know, you're not, it's like they're not getting, it's just people.
If I don't have millions of dollars and I'm not on TV or the big screen all the time, they don't tangibly get it.
Right, because that's not the end of their rainbow, as it were, and that's not what they deem to be successful.
I have a sister who's got a great, beautiful house and cars and vacations and all that. Why? And, you know, when I go back there and I think, boy, this is kind of nice, but would I trade the lifestyle and the approach to
life?
No,
I wouldn't either. I'm also blown away that I have a sister like that who goes to like Disney World repeatedly, and she's older. You know, she's 60, and I don't know what she's doing.
I'm 60.
Well, no, but
I know what you're saying.
I don't understand how she finds...
You're too old to go to Disney World more than once.
I just don't understand how people find pleasures in all sorts of things.
I know.
And I understand that she doesn't understand how I can be happy without a washer and dryer.
Right.
She looks at me and she thinks, you're 50 years old, you're doing coin laundry.
Right.
That's what she thinks.
Right.
But I think, you're trapped in a big-ass house with shit everywhere, and you're still unhappy.
But you know what? Also, I'm at the point where I don't have to denigrate what my sister has in order to make myself feel more uplifted,
But these are the family dynamics that we carry around with
us.
Because when you do go home, this is what you see. The dichotomy, the differences. So it's not that I have to focus on it, but that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
That we choose different paths.
And there are
it's hard to see each other's
very
paths.
Very different values. You know, I'm not interested in jewelry.
Yeah.
I'd like some more nicer clothing, perhaps.
My sister doesn't have just a jewelry box.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have just a jewelry stand.
Yes.
She has there's a
jewelry
they
closet.
Make a closet. They make an armoire closet for jewelry. That's what she has.
I know. My sister has sort of a thing built into her walk-in closet that has...
Can you imagine?
I mean, like, it's a different world.
It's a different world,
you know.
It's all an attempt. I believe that we are all, let me pontificate.
Please, Hannes.
I believe that we are all trying to control our lives, which we have remarkably little control over.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people are like, well, I'm going to control my career and I'm going to make this happen. And some people are like, I'm going to buy a whole bunch of stuff. I'm going to make enough money to buy a whole bunch of stuff and then I can control this. I control the armoire. Yeah. Filled with jewelry.
Right.
I can control the shoe closet.
Right.
I can control where I know, you know, she wants to go out to vacation in the same place.
Because she
wants to do the same thing.
It feels like you're the master.
I know.
You're the master.
And the last times I was home in Pittsburgh, that same sister, she said to me, you know what I always admired about you is that you're funny. I've never been funny. And I thought, man, that is so fucking sad, man. Like, I would rather be funny and have nothing. And not be funny.
But that was nice that she noticed that.
Yeah, I don't know if she actually brought it up. I think I might have finished.
30
she brought
years,
that up.
30 years
no, but
later,
she goes, I don't think she said that I was funny. She said that she wasn't funny. She said, I wish I had been funny. I wish I was funny.
Oh, she must have been.
And I inferred that she meant that I was funny. Therefore, I was like, oh, I'll suck that up.
Oh, that's hilarious. You made up a compliment out of whole cloth.
That's so funny.
Well, here's what it is. What you said. You said you're hungry, but then you get more nourishing food.
Right.
So break that
because
down.
You have to, I think, when you don't take the bait in any kind of dynamic, and now we're talking about families, it's very easy to fall into the same pattern. There's a groove in our brains, there's a groove in our psyche. We fall into it easily. But when you don't, you're like, where am I? Where am I? It's like when you don't do anything, when you don't eat one thing and you're hungry, you'll eat something else. You have to close one. You have to close the door. You have to close the door in order to see that there are other places.
To have some space, right. And if you go one to the next, it's like relationships. You have to get out of a relationship.
Yeah.
Be on your own for a second before the next one. Go ahead.
No, what you just said about grooves, it's not just a metaphorical, like
no,
a groove
it's not.
In your psyche. There's in your head, there are...
It's physiological,
There are electrons and chemicals that have been going on the same route in your brain physically for your entire life. And to change the pattern... The literal pattern of those is to try and change yourself, and that's why it's so unbelievably hard, and your body is like freaking out, makes you physically uncomfortable.
Like, point
of stopping you.
Do you ever meet someone who, as an example, I could say anything, who's always apologizing about him or herself, doesn't know how to take a compliment? Mm-hmm. to stop doing that
yeah.
is a very hard thing because there's a comfort level that you find in doing the things that you've always been doing.
No, that's the entire state of Wisconsin and me. And I'm not kidding. It's like it took me years to even be able to, if somebody would say, "That I saw your show, you were really funny," for me to just go, "Thank you."
Right.
Or, "Aren't you sweet?"
Right.
It's like I used to
How
be like,
Christian
"No, no."
You.
I'm like, "No, no, it's not. I didn't. I was going to do this other joke." And
right.
I would always tell them the thing that I failed to do.
Disclaimer.
Instead of taking the compliment for the mm-hmm. thing that I did do.
And somewhere in your upbringing, you were shown or told that that is what people should do when people tell you that they enjoyed your work.
Right. If you
exactly
said,
right.
I like your shirt. Oh, I got this on sale.
Oh,
this is nothing.
Nothing. Yeah.
Oh, I love
torn.
Your pants. Oh, it's nothing.
My sister gave them to me. Yeah. You know,
yeah,
like
I used to have a joke. It's like, I love those shoes. I got them off a dead guy.
Yes.
I found them on a dead body. It's like, God forbid I spend any money on myself.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Let me ask you, have you ever been tumbled by a wave in the ocean?
Yes.
That is the scariest thing in the world,
absolutely
isn't it?
It is.
Because you're turned upside down.
And I remember being young and being, I remember exactly where I was. It was at Rockaway Beach where my grandparents used to have a place in the summer in Queens. And I was little and I was tumbled and I was like, I was cognizant of what was going on while I was being tumbled thinking, wow, I don't even know if I'm going to get out of this.
I think, I kid you not, Ocean City, New Jersey, tumbling in the waves. I kid you not, I think I saw my life flash before my eyes.
Like, I
thought
it.
I was truly going to drown.
Yeah.
And it was that moment that there was no sky. There was no ceiling. It was all underneath the water.
Yeah.
And I think I saw my little life flash before me.
Yeah. And because it's a power it's so powerful that you know there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
So regarding your story, what was the connection to the story?
Well, the connection was that I needed to where was that? Let me look at where that was. It was that I needed to that when I'm confused.
In other words, like, you're back with your family and you know what's coming, and so then
this had to do with me, not with my family. It has to do with like when things get difficult and I don't know which way to turn.
Right.
And you know, and it's like I said that there are lean times and that it's hard. That it's
so what
hard.
What do you do?
I just have to be still. Sometimes I just have to be still and just not fight. And
yeah, you have to let things wash over you, and people don't do
you
that.
You have to. I mean, more often than not, when you're tossed by a wave, first of all, you're at the shore. You're not. It's not. I'm not talking about like a riptide
or
an undertow that's so strong. I'm talking about just being tossed by a wave.
Right.
And what happens is that the tide comes in and the tide goes out. You know, that's how it goes. And if you're still and you don't fight it, pretty soon the tide's going to go out, and you're going to see sky again. But it's the fighting and the panicking that makes the journey so unpleasant.
I agree completely because that's happened to me. It's like, you know, I'd have a bad day or I'd just be in a bad place and I'd feel like instead of doing what I'm supposed to do and I'm doing nothing because I'm just like, and then I get mad at myself and then blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, eventually you get old enough where you're like, I will stop feeling like this. I will.
Right.
And if I will stop, I'll feel like this for 10 times longer if I get angry at myself for feeling
right.
like
if
it in the
compound
first place.
It, right.
So
just,
but what are the things you do at that moment? Because, I mean, there are solid things we can do, like exercise,
breathe, meditate.
Right.
I mean, just channel the energy, basically.
But you've had issues. Food issues.
Oh, yeah.
And your new one-woman show,
yes.
Does This Show Make Me Look Fat?
Right.
Talks a lot about anorexia.
Right.
And that's
and that
a
was
control,
a control
thing.
Yes, that was my control, not jewelry. Yes, my control was being skinny and denying myself food.
And
it's so primal, I mean.
And when you get to a certain feeling of not eating, there's like a buzz in your body,
isn't
there?
Oh, my God, there's such a buzz, and I miss that.
There's a high.
Oh, my God, do I miss that.
There's a high that you think, like, even if I have a sip of water, I'm going to lose a little bit of this high. Did you ever have that?
No, the water was okay.
Water was okay, yeah.
Why? Did you? Are
no,
you
I'm not. I know, but I've had food issues in terms of, like, you know, that nobody, you can, the power of your mind over food is very powerful.
Everybody has food issues.
Yeah.
That's one thing about this show that I'm doing is that, you know, there are not a lot of anorexics in the world, but everybody has food issues. so everybody can relate to it.
So how did you come about this show, and how is it in relation to your daughter? She's only 12 years old. She sees you writing this. She knows your story.
She knows. She knows I'm anorexic.
And so when you write the story, is it front to back, or is it how do you break it up? Because I heard that the front of it, you put tapes from your family.
Well, not at the
in
front
family
of it.
Therapy. Yeah, the second part of the show.
Yes, I would say probably. I would say halfway through the show, probably.
So your family that you were describing doesn't sound like they would be in therapy together in 1978.
Well, but we were very enmeshed. And still, there's the enmeshment committee still, you know, is presiding, and everybody cared about me. I mean, it was clear that I needed help.
Were these tapes? Tell us about the tapes.
Well, when I was diagnosed definitively, this was in 1978, by a doctor, an internist. And, you know, this was not something that was really on the radar back then. It wasn't talked about the way it is now at all. And he diagnosed me, and he recommended a few things to me, and I can't even remember what the other things were, maybe two or three things. But this one thing that he recommended was a place in New York called the Ackerman Institute for Family Therapy. It still exists at a different location. It was on East 77th Street. And initially, the deal was that only my mother went, and she was completely willing to go. She was the one who would hand me a New York Times article, which I completely dismissed, because anything that I so rejected.
What would an article be like?
Telling about anorexia and how it's, you know, becoming an issue in society.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I would deny it, and then my sister would see something on the news, and she would say to me that, you know, it sounds like you, and I said, no, it's not. Because I was confusing, but I didn't realize I was confusing anorexia and bulimia. Mm. I didn't know enough about it. And I thought, since I don't throw up, then I'm not anorexic. But I didn't realize that when you
vomiting is
bulimia. That's a different offshoot of, and that's a different
it's
eating
still
disorder.
A food issue, right.
It's a different eating disorder. And, but I was so skinny. I weighed less than 85 pounds.
Oh.
And I was wearing clothing from my sisters. I mean, I described this in the show, that she had really nice clothing, and she lent me some things that, you know, that she wasn't using, or she lent me some stuff that she was using, but she had this knit outfit that I loved, and it was a knit skirt, and I literally had to fold the waistband over about 4 inches and safety pin it so it wouldn't fall down.
So, but
while
when
I was
did
at
your
the filing
when
cabinet.
Did your family say, let's go to family therapy? And where did you
well,
go?
Well, they didn't say it.
How did it?
What happened was, this doctor recommended it. And I called my mother when I left. I called my mother right after I left therapy, and I asked her if she would come with me. And she said she would. So I guess I was the one who looked into it. My boss, where I was working, was the one who encouraged me to go see this doctor, because she was so concerned about the way I looked. And I was living, where was I living at the time? I can't even remember if I was living in Manhattan or living with my parents. I was back and forth. That was the period of time that I said, in my early 20s, it was a terrible time. I was in the house, out of the house, in an apartment, out of an apartment. It was just, I was.
And you were eating on your own, so you had control.
Yes.
You're cooking on your own, doing your own.
I was doing my own thing. Nobody could force me to eat something.
So once you were in therapy, who was taping it?
Well, it was, so anyway, so my mother went with me initially. My father wanted nothing to do with any kind of therapy. He didn't believe in it.
Yeah, because at that time, it seemed very.
Well, my father was just not he was not very open to
my therapy. Dad never would have gone to therapy.
And then my oldest sister was mad at me about something, so she didn't go. And my middle sister had just had a baby, so she was, kind of acclimating to her new life, but she was eventually going to come. But then actually my oldest sister was the second one who entered, so it was three of us. And then I guess my sister Leslie came in, and then our therapist, Peggy Papp, a wonderful woman, called my dad, and she was able, first of all, she wasn't a family member, and she was able to talk to him in a way that made it palatable. And probably, I didn't know what she said to him, but probably maybe she frightened him a little bit. I don't know, because I was at a really scary place. You know, I do talk about some statistics in my show, and anorexia has the highest fatality rate of any mental illness, and it's 20%.
Fatal.
Yeah.
If you have anorexia nervosa, 20% chance you're going to die from it.
I mean, and that's pretty high. And I'm one of the lucky ones, and I still wish I were thinner.
What were you eating at the time? What were you eating?
Oh, my God, the tiniest little... I would just try to fend off my hunger with anything, water, coffee, diet soda. You know, I would just eat a tiny... And I was a teacher for 1 year. When I was anorexic, I don't think I weighed quite as little, but I probably weighed in the mid-90s.
Is that what you went to school for?
Well, I went to school for theater, and which I didn't like the theater department there, so I took an interdisciplinary major. I kind of made it up, and I did a double major. It was media and communications, which involved some theater, film, and then my mother said, you know, you should get an education degree to fall back on. And, of course, I had absolutely no self-esteem or confidence. So I thought, okay. So I took an English education degree, and I taught eighth grade English for 1 year. Which I didn't like. It was not what I wanted to do.
Right, right, right.
Not that it is the most noble profession ever.
Right.
But it's not what I wanted to do. And what was great is that I met my best friend of 40 years there.
Oh,
so
that's
neat. It was wonderful. It was a great. I mean, I had a great
looking
time.
Looking back over your life, you definitely see why things happen.
Yes.
And this led me to this, and this person led me
and
to
now
this.
And now I don't have to look back. Now I see why. I mean, I was in New York last week, and I got lost. I went the wrong direction when I got out of a subway stop because I went out the wrong exit and something.
Yeah.
But I ended up going someplace where I needed to find a store, so it was great. So I was there.
Yeah.
Then another time I got on the downtown side instead of the uptown side of the subway, and I ended up meeting somebody who was friends with a comic here. And it was like, you know, I love when things like that happen.
Yeah, so do I.
So anyway, so I taught 1 year outside of Philly, and I have a couple of Facebook friends who were my students back
then.
That's
nice.
I know, it is nice. And who said very nice things to me. Actually, one of them said very nice things to me online about this story.
That's
it was
nice.
Very, very kind.
Yeah.
And I mean, kind in a way that he had compassion.
Don't things like that make your day?
I have a
document on my desktop at all times. When somebody does something nice or that touches me, I can jot it down because I always have so much that I'm bummed out about.
That's a great idea.
And just the other day I wrote down, I'm thankful for this guy, David, who ran after me because I mentor this writing group at my child's school, my daughter's school,
These
third graders, 31 kids, out of control.
Oh, wow.
But this guy had brought the snack that day, and he had only brought 27 juice boxes, and he is Korean, and he's chasing after me, Christine, I forgot 3 juice boxes, come with me, and he makes me, like, go to his car, and just to give me these 3 juice boxes, and I'm like, that's
so sweet.
Is quality, man.
Yes.
Like that, and I jot those things down, because that's what I have to remind myself when I get really bummed out, that there are people doing generous and kind things.
What bums you out? No, really, honestly, look at your day. What's the first thing today that bummed you out?
I got to feed my daughter, and I need money.
Right.
That's what it is.
But the thing is, and I understand I get crazy about, I get crazy about the same stuff over and over, too. But, you know, acceptance is a great remedy for so many things, because if you're bummed out every day about the same thing,
yeah.
it's like It's like the you know what they say the definition of
insanity is repeating the same thing over and over, getting a different result, thinking you'll get a different result.
Right.
Well, listen, you know that I'm not a bummed out person. I'm like the most optimistic.
Well, you're very upbeat.
It's insanely how optimistic
I am. Your energy is frenetic.
Yeah.
And I get that. I get that. Like my husband will say, like when I'm in that place, he goes, oh, "You're on a tear.
Yeah.
You're on a tear." But you know, every morning you get up, you have to feed your daughter, and you don't have money. Okay. Okay, so that's a given. But you know what? If you look back, if you're feeding your daughter every day.
No, it always works out.
It always works out. Right. So instead of getting angry at the situation, just try it for one day.
Mm-hmm.
Just get up in the morning and just accept that I don't have money and I have to feed my daughter.
Right. What I do
often is I
go hiking when I get like really.
That's great.
So I'll go hiking and I'll literally like run up this hill.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, well, if I'm running,
so you've missed
legs
the whole
are,
hiking part of
my
it.
My legs are burning.
Yes.
And this has got to be good. Do you know what I mean? But it's like, it is funny. Like I'm happy I don't do it with food. You know, I'm happy. I don't binge.
Right. But are you binging on exercise?
That could be. I sometimes might. But that can't be as bad.
It can be, actually.
Yeah, but I know.
It's called exercise bulimia.
Right. But I'm not exercising over 2 hours a day.
Oh, that's great.
I don't suffer from any of these problems.
I want to get back one more time, though. Why were they taping the therapy sessions with your family?
Because it was a new program. You know, this was all very new back then. This is
in the 70s, therapy was big.
This is 1978 or 79, and it was very different. Anorexia was a new ailment that was not really explored that much.
Yeah,
I mean, people had it, but it wasn't as prevalent, and it wasn't being treated. So this was a kind of a pilot program.
Interesting.
And part of the program was we had to sign a waiver that said that we were going to be taped. These tapes were going to be used for professional use. And I have met people who have gone to school to be social workers and therapists who've seen
the Ladman Chronicles.
Yes, they're great tapes.
What did they call them as a piece?
I don't know. I know that that Peggy wrote a book of case studies of a lot of her therapy, patients, and our family's in the book, and not all of these are eating disorders, but this one, it had to do with what her book is called, The Process of Change.
Wow.
And I've always had a great resistance to change.
You've got mail.
Oh my Jesus. God,
I'm
what
sorry.
Happened?
I don't know how that happened. I'm
my
sorry.
God.
I don't know what
that
happened.
Guy.
Sorry.
He's working. That guy's working.
Yeah.
Anyway.
AOL.
I know, really.
It's so fucking old.
I know. But some people
came up by
are
I'm sorry.
No, but it's just
and
the
it
idea.
Works. I know.
Oh.
I know.
Okay.
Geritol. anyway, so.
That guy's dead, by the way.
The AOL guy, the Geritol guy.
I'm just making the Geritol guy is definitely dead.
So I think that you have got to be so grateful that your father went along with this because it sounds like it was personal. I mean, they're taping this, and your father must have been like, "What are you talking about?"
Well, you know what's interesting? My father was actually a very good patient in the group. He really was.
Yeah,
he was able to be very honest. Very honest.
And that's a very giving thing to do for your child, to go into that situation.
Yes. I mean, I think that my father definitely had, he was an angry guy. He was scary.
Yeah.
Sounds to me like that she must have
opinionated.
She must have scared him. She must have imparted to him.
But you know what?
This is not some touchy,
we're
feely.
We're not kidding
yeah,
here.
This is not like we're trying to make her feel good about her. You know, self and hurt. You know, it's like this is
life
really
and death.
Dangerous.
Yeah, and so they've used these tapes, and the name of my chapter, not my chapter, our chapter, because we were the patient. Really, the family is the patient. Although I'm the focus. I mean, I'm the
you're the star.
Reason why
everyone else
there.
Is a supporting patient.
Right,
you're above the title.
Right, I am. That's right. But it was called, God, what was it called? The daughter who said no.
Wow. That's
because
incredible.
I had a very hard time saying no.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see how that's followed me in life, how I've had to fight that urge to cave and to be compliant and to be acquiescent. But, I mean, it was so hard for me to individuate. And I think that's why, I mean, you know, when you analyze anorexia, it's a rejection of nourishment, and it's a real maternal rejection. You know, it's a rejection of the mother.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But it's, you know, you want to, I never wanted to need anything. I felt like, you know, I am so disappointed and by everything that I'm going to be so self-reliant that no one is ever going to hurt me. And I mean, it's, you know, it's crazy. Yeah,
you just push yourself so hard to think that you can control it.
Mm-hmm. And you can see, and I mean, in what I read, you can see like the elements of it in how I got myself out of that house.
Yeah.
You know, I was so focused and so determined. And I really can't tell you much about my high school years.
Yeah.
I really can't.
Well, it didn't seem like you cared about like your classmates and graduating together and prom and homecoming.
I never
and all
went.
That crap.
First of all, I didn't even know there was a prom. Yeah. I thought that they only happened in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I swear to God. Yeah. I thought it was not something that every school did. And I never graduated with my class. I never went to a ceremony. I just got out.
Okay, so here's what I know about you. At 15 years old, you met Jerry Seinfeld in Israel on a high school trip.
We're going to talk about this?
Okay. Well, I just want to say that happened in high school.
Yes.
And so you were just
Well, I was almost out of high school at that point. I only had, like, I just had that fall
semester.
Yeah,
because you graduated early. You graduated, you were only 16.
Right, so I had a half a year
left.
But
it just seems really funny to fast forward and think like, oh yeah, I met Jerry. We were 15, we're on this thing, and we're at, like, was it the kibbutz?
Did he say, what is the deal with this kibbutz?
Well, you know, was it funny that sometimes
Jerry... Could I get some pork rinds? What is wrong?
Jerry, we had a guide. I was 15, he was 16, and we had a guide on our tour, and I think his name was Eitan, actually, I remember this. And Jerry would sometimes take over for Eitan, and he would, like, do the tour.
He was
very funny.
Oh, I bet.
And I'm the person who told Jerry that he could be a stand-up comic, and it's a viable
Because you knew of
career.
That career. Because I have written down here, I forget where I read it or saw it, but you decided at 13 you wanted to be a comedian.
I did.
That
but
is
it took
young.
Me another half, another lifetime. To really do it,
well,
I was
still,
really
though,
scared.
At 13, so that was interesting because he probably thought, like, I didn't know. I mean, did he say, like, yeah, I've always wanted to be a comic? Or he's
no.
Like,
I mean, I honestly was the one who told him about that.
That's so fucking cool.
And then when he and I got back from Israel, we went to, I think it was then, yeah, we went to Catch a Rising Star together and just to check it out. And we saw Andy Kaufman.
Oh, wow.
I know.
That's amazing.
And he did the bongos. He did the crying bongos.
Well, I was thinking about when you came up in comedy in the early 80s, you were with people like Paul Reiser, Roseanne, of course, Sandra Bernhardt, Jonathan Katz, Paul Provenza, all those people.
Yeah. I mean, Reiser was slightly before me and Provenza was slightly before me, too. Like, just like they were kind of like they started like late 70s.
Yeah.
But I came up with such a great crop.
You really did. Carol Leifer.
I mean, like, such funny, funny people. I mean...
So then you went on to write
such
for...
a great... I mean, you know, Larry David was before me, but still, you know, you could see him in the clubs. Richard Lewis was still performing in the clubs
you
when I was there.
You went on to write for different sitcoms like The Caroline Ray Show, Caroline in the City, Roseanne.
Right.
King of Queens. Mm-hmm. You wrote for these different shows.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever look at Seinfeld and think, like, shit, man, I'd like to write for Jerry?
You know, I didn't really want to be a writer.
Interesting.
I wanted to be on the show.
Yeah.
And then the Roseanne job came up. They offered me a job because they were looking for new women, and I was suggested.
Well, probably maybe also that was around the Carson time, right? And she was on Carson, you were on Carson, and so-
well, Roseanne and I started at the Comedy Store the same year.
Wow!
And she was discovered, like, we were rehearsing this show It was a George Schlatter show, a comedy special called Funny. And he was doing it was like almost like a variety type show, mm-hmm. but it was not live. It was taped things, different things that are funny. And one of the segments of the show was called, I hate this, The Girls of the Comedy
so
Store.
So the belly room thing.
Well, yeah, but I had just moved there. I had just moved there that summer. And so they were already doing this, and I wasn't a part of it. So it was okay. But then Mitzi said to me that she wanted me to be part of it. I said, great. So it was like 11 of us, and Roseanne was one of them. And one afternoon, Maureen Murphy was also one, and she was like one of the first women to do stand-up on The Tonight Show. I mean, besides Joan Rivers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about of our generation.
Right.
Actually, maybe Joan Rivers was it. I mean, I don't even know who else.
Phyllis Diller.
She had done The Tonight Show?
I don't know.
I believe
I'm sure.
She
I'm
had
pretty
had
sure it. She had. Yeah. 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 But
Moms Mabley
had done The Tonight Show.
Brett Summers.
Oh, wait a second. No, you're right. There were
Betty White.
But you could count them on one hand.
Yes,
probably.
There were very few. But then it became like a broader field. And Maureen was on The Tonight Show. And she had told in secret, she had told Jim McCauley, who was the then booker,
The Tonight Show.
The comedy booker on The Tonight Show. She had told him that he should come in and check out Roseanne. And he sat in the dark in the main room.
Yeah.
And we were rehearsing in the afternoon. And he watched us rehearse. And then when we broke to get, you know, to take a break, you know, before we went back to rehearsal, we were all getting drinks in the kitchen and stuff. And Macaulay walks up to Roseanne and hands her his card. And he said, you know, call tomorrow. I'd like you to do the show. And she's like, I guess she didn't look. Oh, no, he said, maybe he didn't hand it to her. He said, call me tomorrow. I'd like you to do the show. And she kind of like didn't know who he was. And he says, you don't know who I am, do you? And he hands her his business card. And she sees
The Tonight Show.
Yeah. And the logo and, you know, the and so we're in the kitchen like getting soda from the gun, you know.
Yeah.
And she goes tearing down that hallway out to the back parking lot screaming. And we're like, oh, my God, what's the matter? You know, we thought something horrible happened. And we go out there and she's jumping up and down.
That's so
she
nice.
Said, I'm going to do The Tonight Show. I'm going to do The Tonight Show. And so Karen Haber, who's another comic there, and I went to see heard the taping that night. And she was so nervous, I remember.
Oh, fuck.
And she, you should see her, like Google her first shot. It was great. It was electrifying.
Yeah.
And she was so nervous. She turned on her heel and she disappeared
before
behind
he could
the curtain.
Call her over.
Like you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to stand on your mark until they cut the camera. But she was so nervous.
She just walked away.
She just disappeared behind. She went back behind the camera.
He might have called her over.
And he was laughing. I think he would have called her over. Yes.
Listen, she has such a specific voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can imagine that somebody would see her one time and say like, boom, there's a star.
And it was such such a clear voice.
So
and it
definitive.
Was so, it was so, I mean, the timing was so perfect
for
her.
No, I can still remember. No, I'm pretty sure I saw. I mean, I have seen it. I probably saw it the first time.
It was the housewife.
I'm a domestic goddess.
Right. Yeah. And
that's
it was
all
like
you can.
She represented housewives who had no voice.
That's cool, man.
You know, she was the voice of the housewife.
Do where it's like, you know, every what you have to say to your man, it's like, oh no, stop! It's too much. Oh, I can't take it.
Oh, I didn't know.
You're hurting
remember.
Me. It was something like that. It was like, but in that voice, like, you're an animal.
And I think she most, I think she closed on this joke. She's like, you know, and they never know where anything is. Like, you're like, they think your uterus is a tracking device. And she said, husband always says, Roseanne, where's the Cheetos? She said, and I think she says, like, he can't go pick up the sofa cushion himself.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And then it is such a clear visual of the women, these women across the country who had no voice who no one listened to, who thought were nothings. And here Roseanne was giving them not only a voice, but a face.
Yeah, and not only was that, and her sitcom was obviously great, but what I always loved about that show was that it was finally a cast of, like, John Goodman looked like a guy who'd be married to Roseanne.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like one of them is usually the woman, but not always, like, it'll be like some insane, one of them is insanely attractive.
Right.
And the other one is fat.
No, the whole family was
crazy. Yeah, they look like people.
Cast so beautifully.
And so let me ask you about this. I know your first one woman show was called Scaredy Pants, and your next one woman show is going to be called Does This Show Make Me Look Fat?
Right.
And you have a podcast coming up?
Yeah, I heard that you have a podcast with Mindy Sterling.
Yes. You know Mindy?
I know her. We did Top Tune together just recently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But you're going to have a show called Brilliantly Annoying
Moms? No, it's a new title.
What's the new title?
Where'd you get that?
I don't know. Man.
It's on your website. I'm looking at right now.
I got to change it. Okay. Yeah. No, it's called Nobody Ever Listens to Me.
Okay.
Nobody Ever Listens.
Hey, listen, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
Oh, my God. All right.
Music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the storyworthy wheel of truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Passport. Passport.
All right, I'm gonna time.
Oh my God.
1 minute.
You know, I had to get a new passport recently, and my joke is that the good news is that I can use it until I'm 85, because the picture was so awful. It looked like I don't even know what made me think that the lighting in Rite Aid would be flattering. I am cheating a little bit, picking up some lines, and I have to explain it because I feel like I'm cheating. So I have to tell you that because I'm using some jokes that I actually have used, so I have to tell you this.
Oh, we don't. We have full disclosure here.
I know. I know. I really shouldn't do that. But anyway,
if you laughed at that, I wrote that. I had to work on it.
I didn't just make this up. But I actually took some selfies of myself and I went on the passport site and I looked to see what the guidelines were and what you had to do. And I actually took it to the passport office. I said, please let me use this. Please, can I use this one? That other one is so horrible. Please. I was like, and they said, maybe you can. You know, maybe you can. And they said, let's just send it in and see. And they used it. They used my selfie. And so you don't have to go to stupid fucking Rite Aid.
I'm literally about to renew my passport.
Look at people in Rite Aid. They all look like they should go to the pharmacy immediately.
They want you to look in see yourself in a little mirror where you do the sunglasses and go, I need to go pick up some Imodium AD. Something's horribly wrong.
And also, the guy tells you that you can't smile. And I think it's because they want everyone to look like a terrorist, so it's a level playing field. But I actually had a slight smile in mine. I just was a little like...
A little knowing.
Yeah, like
I've been around.
It's in the eyes. Yeah. It's in the eyes.
Yeah, I've traveled.
And I looked,
You should bump me up to first class.
But now my hair is gray, so now I
love your hair. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
I don't say gray. It looks more like silver.
Silver.
Fox.
I know people are
really
saying
pretty.
That.
Yeah, it's a beautiful color.
Some of it's silver.
You.
Some of it's gold. Silver.
Oh, that's
and gold.
Old. That's old. Silver. That's old highlighting. That'll
listen,
be gone.
Listen, we
got
to wrap this up, but I want to tell you one of my favorite quotes of yours, and it is this: Kathy Ladman says, "When Anne Frank said, 'Despite everything, I believe that people are really good at heart,' she must have had her YouTube comments turned off."
Yes, and that was written because somebody said something so scathingly mean to me.
People are crazy.
That I said, I can't do this.
Haters gonna hate,
but
man.
I really wish I could turn them back on and just say, fuck you anyway. You know, you want to say that?
Yeah, we got to wrap this up. But some of the good news is that we don't have, when we were growing up, Kathy, we didn't have the technology we have. Like, so there was no Snapchat or these selfies or things. Because I think that if that was happening when I was growing up, there would be, I would have made a lot of poor choices.
I know. And the kids, you imagine that the mean things that kids say about each other. And I'm telling my daughter, you cannot put up with this.
I saw this really funny meme with this grandmother, like in the early 1900s on it. And it was, you know, something like, you know, my grandmother, whatever. And then the meme from, you know, fast forward 2015. So now it's fast forward 2050.
Yes.
And you're looking back at my grandmother.
Oh, my God.
And there's this slutty girl, taking this stupid selfie.
I know. I saw it. Yes, man. I've seen that too. I know. It's really, I know. But it's going to look different. It's going to look different.
Well, I'm glad that.
Idiocracy.
I think everything happens for a reason. And I think it's better that I grew up when I did, then. Do you know what I mean? Like a timing.
There would be a trail of upsetting pornographic / drug images across the country.
But I think the theme of this show, I think, is to allow yourself to just be and to move through change and to know that change is going to be uncomfortable.
Change is always good, too.
It is always good.
It ends up being good.
There was a wonderful GIF. Is it called a GIF or a GIF? The things that
there's two different things, I think.
The GIF. What's it called?
GIF.
Hey, young
GIF?
Person. What's his name?
Hey, yeah, young person. You have no idea? All
yeah,
right.
Anyway.
So
I think
anyway,
it's called a GIF.
Okay, so there was a wonderful one that I shared yesterday of Prince.
Yeah.
Of going through all his names, all the different years and all the different albums and all the different ways that he looked.
Yeah.
And that's what made him, I think, so unique, was that he was not afraid to constantly redo and reemerge and rebirth, you know? And he did it for himself. He was an artist. Yeah. You know, things moved through him.
His talent was just so stunning.
But his willingness to allow it to move through him,
right,
besides what his gift. People have gifts, but if you suppress them, then what good are they?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on our show
today. Thank you.
KathyLadman.com.
I have headphone hair now.
KathyLadman.com and at KathyLadman on Twitter. Thank you so much.
Yes, very cryptic.
And okay. I want to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Sean Merrick and Roddy Swearingen. And, of course, Ben Stewart. Thanks for your help today, Ben.
Thank you, of course, Ben.
Maria Spertolozzi, Andrew Stephen, all the fine people here at Sideshow
Network.
Just all
wandering through, giving the wrap it up sign. You got to go watch.
And on behalf of John Thomas Griffith, you know, he wrote the theme song, Follow Me.
Yeah. Whatever.
I love that guy. And on behalf, one more time, of our storyteller, Kathy Ladman, thank you so much. And on behalf of you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it the story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.